the start then this morning. I'm apologise about the way we sort of set out the room. It's not the best way of doing it, but I fear if we try reorganising ourselves now, we won't move anywhere. So I think we stay where we are. Hopefully the observers don't mind projecting a little bit to the rest of the room. So this session has been set up as our observers' commentary, discussion, telling us what they saw over the last couple of days, giving us a sense of perhaps some of the bigger themes that they've been thinking about, perhaps that have cut across a number of the different activities and panels over the last few days, or not simply just the themes, maybe it's more about the microscopic detail, an issue that they've picked up on. What we're planning on doing then is to move around almost incrementally, but move around in terms of ideas as opposed to individuals. And once we've developed an idea and discussed it among the group and exhausted it, we will then move on to the next one. So perhaps if I can leave it over to you then, and who wants to begin?
Well, I find myself at the head of this table. You may be wondering why I've gathered you here today, ladies and gentlemen of the board. I was just going to maybe kick start this. We had a small discussion before in which ideas were circulating, but I was just picking up on what you just said then, which was a kind of summary of our role, which was slightly alarmed me in sort of mismatch with the activity that had happened. But you said what they saw, and picking up on what they saw, and one of the first words that certainly I brought back was the word which was bounced around a bit yesterday, apart from Martin's paper and other discussions we had after, the word listen. And I think that was a kind of key, and then in a kind of what's going on here, just looking back at your very first introduction notes, which I think not everyone, Derek certainly wasn't here for. One of the things you said, apart from talking about the threshold apparatus, was how to ground a sensory critique of the contemporary urban fabric. And there's been a lot of discussion of senses or sensory thing, and I think maybe beginning with active listening, which I was saying is thinking partly about Martin's paper and also about what we were doing yesterday in the station, is to reverse some of the senses, to disconnect the immediate identification of a sense with an organ. So to, in the case of a deaf child, to hear through touch, or to see through hearing, or to hear, or to the deaf child actually to hear through sight often. Or to the adult even, and so that to silence is to kind of enter the dark. And what we were doing, it seemed to me what we were doing yesterday, partly almost interesting follow on from that, when we were walking around the station, was listening, was seeing with our ears, partly, to meld together the audio tape, the soundtrack, and what we were seeing, while at the same time the sort of invocation from the instruction from the all-seeing camera, the all-seeing eye, which I think was to look, to see, to look for suspicious, translating what suspicious might be, but to look. And how might there be a security camera which didn't look, but which heard? Or I don't know, these are just things that we're talking about, especially, as I said, the idea of translation as listening as well, or as listening as essential part of the translation.
Okay, listening. So I would say, I thought about another term very close to listen or listening, which is which has been said several times for 2 days, which is resonance. Seems to me that it is one of the basic notions that could help us in order to clarify what we mean by ambience or atmosphere, which is like a kind of basic grounding phenomenon related to atmosphere. And maybe that raises a question, which is the sonic experience would be kind of a basic background in order to conceptualize the notion of an ambience or atmosphere. Is the sound one of the way to get into the core of the notion? If we use the term resonance is related to the act of hearing, of the sense of hearing. So is there a special direction in that sense, from that sense, that can help us maybe more than other senses, as visual, for example, that could be helpful in order to go further? But at the same time, maybe we could say the same with the sense of smell for example. Has been already theorized in that sense, in the way that the smell brings the kind of a diffuse experience, which is also part of the experience of atmosphere and ambience. So, in a way, maybe it could be the question could be how each sense can help us in order to bring a new perspective. The idea of ambience or atmosphere. I mean, maybe each of them have a specific way to deal with the notion. And so to start with listening and resonance is maybe one way. Maybe there's other notions coming from other senses.
Can I pick up on a term that you used? And that was grounding phenomenon, which is interesting, but it strikes me as kind of counterintuitive when you think about atmosphere. The idea that there's a ground to that. So there's a... And sometimes the language that we use to think about atmosphere almost tethers it too much. So it was just something that struck me about that term, the grounding phenomenon of atmosphere. In terms of the senses, what I was thinking about was attention.
Yes.
And what I liked about the walk was the way in which our attention was deliberately directed in the case of the kind of instructions. And also then in the other walks, how it was a little more, our attention was allowed to be more spacious. It wasn't so directed. So there was a relationship between volume in the kind of acoustic sense, but also in the spacious sense that I found interesting in relation to attention. Sometimes it was very focused or directed, and when we wandered with the shorter, literally your attention starts to wander as well, and it sort of expand into the space. So different kind of techniques technologies of attending to them through those sorts of spaces, I think, is quite interesting. I think that's my attention.
And I would say that's going back to that kind of the brief as well, which is about a sensory critique and thinking about one thing, which is things which came to me about the sort of ambiance or one of the activities of the sort of body station is to control, is to limit and control certain things. And the purpose, say, of the notices of the signage or whatever, and even as well pointed out yesterday about the kind of low platform at one end, the half ceiling at one end of the station, is to offer a kind of limit to your attention. And maybe, because I think, if we just keep getting back to the notion of challenging something, to refuse the attention, you know, the because we're being called upon, again, what's the kind of message as in terms of, you know, surveillance and the rest of it, is for vigilance, a certain kind of attention which could be heightened attention, which is vigilance. But that's not the same as a kind of contrary attention, or which lots and lots of art practices in the 60s and 70s especially played with or called upon a challenge to, and certain art practices called upon, you know, challenged your habits of attention and also your ability, you know, duration, different kinds of experience of attention, the appeal to boredom, the resistance to boredom, and that the work of the station is also to, you know, be visually busy, to you know, to call you for moments of attention, to call you visually, and so maybe a kind of resistance like we said, is to simply, there was a point where a lot of people got confused yesterday, I think, at the very beginning of the guided walk, where there was no, people said, oh, there's no message, there's nothing. And that was kind of interesting, because it was a kind of, I'm being guided, but I'm hearing no instructions. And that, what do you do at that point? Do you assume the technology is broken? Do you, you know, the message is void? Or do you start to look away? Or you would find yourself sometimes, because of the right time lapse as well, in the slightly the wrong place at the right time, or the right place at the wrong time in terms of the instruction you were being given. So you could tell you to walk down some stairs and look to the left, and you might be walking down a different staircase and looking to the left. And that could also be a kind of challenging, I think, to maybe move on from that. It was as you said, different kind of spacious. To open up, the challenge is to open up a kind of spacious attention, which is also paying attention to the ways in which your attention is being, you know, addressed and pulled upon. And what was I saying? The mixing up of senses that I was talking about would be maybe a way of a kind of intervention as well to tuck, you know. I wonder in what ways we are allowed to or not allowed to touch things in that way, there seems to be very little tactile appeal in the presentation of the station. So what would we be paying attention to in terms of not necessarily sight or hearing? I mean, hearing, there's also, it seemed like there was, you know, it's hard, there was a point where people got confused as well between whether they, or somebody certainly got confused about whether they were actually hearing messages coming from the station or hearing messages on one of the second or third tapes, where actually you were getting a mixture, sort of mixing tape of different places. And that I was only aware that there was very little kind of oral simulation in that station, except for the regular intermission kind of soft spoken and very, very correct pronunciation. This is a security announcement, always announced by, you know, to please pay attention. What ought to be a pay attention. And except when you heard the SNCF, when you heard the Golden Noise, it seemed much, much more noisy. And I was also thinking about, again, the morning paper on birdsong, and you don't hear many birds. You see two pigeons, maybe, in the station, but I heard no kind of animal sound. I don't know. Again, like resonance of the word vibe came to me last night. I was thinking something we used to talk about as a kind of vibe, as a vibration, which could also be a vibration which is, you know, affecting the different, you know, names, but in different ways.
Okay, maybe back to the seminar, I mean to the papers, but before that, about the attention, I was just thinking maybe there's a link that could be made between attention and ambience and atmosphere, which is from Walter Benjamin, that has been cited several times to the seminar, and which talks about distracted attention. Maybe there's a link that could be made between the sensory environment of modernity and the configuration of attention in a specific way from the distraction, for example. Just if come back to the papers, I had like three general remarks that was coming right away after the paper. One is the fact that there was a great diversity of papers that was given. They were very diverse, and in a way, I thought it was maybe a way to explore the limits of the, and the range of the notion that we are dealing with, like ambience and atmosphere. So maybe one of the questions was, how far can we go in this exploration without losing the phenomenon of the ambience or atmosphere? How far can we go? And when does it stop, in a certain way? So that would be one of the questions. The second one is the density of the papers. I thought it was, I mean, they were very, very dense in terms of content, and in a way they also require from people to take some risks when they were talking. Like, it, in a way, it was very much related also to a personal way to deal with what research is and how we can get involved in the research and we're doing. And the third remark, I think, which is for me something which I really keep in mind now, which is the great relevancy of the world of art in the questioning of ambience and atmosphere. I think we saw that from different ways, from poetry, dance, installation, I mean different ways to that was brought, that was bringing art in a way to reflect on the ambience, and maybe even more the relevancy, but the necessity to bring the world of art in order to deal with this kind of question. Mm. Can we get out of, to get rid of the art when we deal with this question? I'm not sure anymore. I think that's a very important matter to put it into discussion. So that was the basic framework that was coming.
Yeah, I mean, the question of art or aesthetics is an interesting one, because St. Pancras really captured, but like drew me in as a piece of architecture. So it took me a long time to attend to this interest in cameras. You know, okay, the camera's fine, but it's just such a fantastic space. But I don't mean that to belittle the point about the cameras. I mean that to make the point about the cameras stronger, because it's this relationship between the force of aesthetic qualities that are tied up with atmospheres and you know, the diversion of attention in a particular way. So yeah, that interest in aesthetics kind of cuts both ways. And the trouble that some people, certainly in relation to critique or being critical, have with foregrounding the aesthetic qualities of places, in part because those qualities are seen to, you know, distract you from the kind of hidden techniques and technologies. And it reminded me also of Crystal Palace, you know, the space. And I was rereading Marshall Berman's book as part of lectures, undergraduate lectures, and there's a quote from a German who visited Crystal Palace in 1851. And this is what the German said about Crystal Palace in 1851. The blue painted girders range closer and closer together until they are interrupted by a dazzling band of light, the transept, which dissolves into a distant background where all materiality is blended into the atmosphere. Okay, so this is Crystal Palace in 1851. So that's what I remember in that space. And then also the Betjeman quote, which I assume is a Betjeman quote. It was on the pavement, imprisoned in a cage of sound. Even the trivial seems profound. So, I mean, I guess to take poetry as a kind of way in which the aesthetic quality of atmospheres might, not to get some purchase on them, but to think about how it might be expressed. And again, I'm also reminded of the presentation that Robert gave us, and the sort of symbolic resources, but I think those resources are more than symbolic. They're kind of material and affective as well. And they also need to emphasize the kind of voice and the rhythm and tone and timbre of the voice in this process of translation. And I know that Anya is here, and I direct you to her work on the kind of voice. It's really good. I was reminded of, sorry, one more thing about this, how poems just offers really rich way of thinking about the material transformations that we might understand as translation. There's an Irish poet, Austin Clark, and he describes this growing intensity of the voice as the mist becoming rain, which I really like, because it sort of captures how, you know, the density of materiality condenses, or it you know, starts to precipitate some different quality of state. It's still vague, but I guess part of the challenge of these concepts like ambience and atmosphere is to be vague in the right way, so that you can, you know, generate that sense of what's happening.
We did mention in a very brief conversation on pavement, the Marshall Berman book, which I was thinking of as well separately, the orbit with the title, which is Orbit is Solid Melts into Air.
Yeah.
And as I was saying, from the preliminary discussion we were having, that was something that seemed to me very well resonant in the, not only in the work from Marx, but also in the act of what's happening here, but also in its reference kind of to back to the Tempest, so to the words of, you know, to poetry, to talk about the ability of things to solidify, to, and that's not just a romantic notion, but I say going back to the Greeks, the idea of what the work of poetry is to solidify, to give form to, give means to, but also to enter into a realm where things can be both metaphor and, as in the Greek thought, metaphor in terms of moving. So sort of real, so act, as well as another kind of order, like a symbolic order. But I was, and this just reminds me of what I was, before I forget, the thing I was talking about earlier, of Giuseppe Pinoni's piece in, we saw in the afternoon yesterday, some of this did, which was surrounded by his kind of, some of his poetry from, some of it more recent, like 2000, some of it from much earlier, which was a kind of, and again, most of that was in translation, I assume, but a sort of a moving between states and the work of the artist as a kind of intervention, but also as an ability to kind of, to give form to, but to address a kind of, well, that word that came up a lot yesterday, in between, a kind of movement, a kind of movement between states, which maybe is what you're talking about, kind of the ability to play, to open up, to question, and but also through the use, his use of wax especially, the idea of moving between a solid and a liquid state, which is something that comes up in a poetic, in all senses, liquefy, or some of the, it's a kind of trope, you know, moving from into, you know, melting into air, into thin air, leave not a rat behind, and yet leaving this poem, you know, what stands here but these words. So sorry, I'm kind of moving on, but that idea of something having a form which can allow a movement, you know, offering form, like in a poem or in a cast of a piece of a tree, a form which allows you to move between places and between states. That's a very abstract way of describing it. But I suppose I'd say with you that alongside your insistence on the relevance to and the resources enabling the resources of art. Art in the broadest sense of especially we're doing it of poetry as well.
Can I just bring back to the first one of the other questions that you raised, and through the idea of rhythm.
Yeah.
So rhythm as yeah. You know, something that allows you to give form to process in differentiating itself rather than something that becomes an object. And So to take in the work of somebody like Henri Lefebvre and, you know, rhythm analysis, mm-hmm. which on one level I really like, but then on another level it's kind of rhythm everywhere, mm-hmm. and what's not rhythmic, okay? Mm-hmm. And that reminded me of the question that you raised about how far does, mm-hmm. how far did these concepts, or ambience and atmosphere go? So when, if they're everywhere and anything, you know, what is it that we're really attending to? So is it sort of shifts, transformations, alterations that are actually really the interesting thing, rather than some kind of broader claim that, you know, atmospheres and ambiances are that kind of ontological, are part of the, just the condition in which we live. So I'm just kind of curious, is once you say, yeah, go look for rhythm, you find it everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I guess, you know, Paul might speak to that as well, but, you know, what, What then do you look for? Shifts, transformations, or moments, or eruptions? Because I think it was in one of the presentations that the notion of eruption, an atmosphere, there was an eruptive quality.
Yeah,
that was
interruption.
So, what is that eruptive quality? Mm. Or should that be the thing that we focus on?
Is that what the challenge, is that what the critique becomes, or that where the critique is grounded? That I was thinking about a pulse as well when you say rhythm. So.
Yeah, on this matter, I was thinking two different things, which is the idea of expression that has been said yesterday, which is, I think, another term very important in this field of research, in the way that it brings the question of how is it possible to articulate the relationship between expression as not having a specific object outside of itself, expression is of itself, and the notion of representation. How do we deal with this articulation between expression and representation? And in the way when we, so that, so where also to bring something which is usually not that much developed, when you say the quality of voice, of gesture, the rhythm, or also another term that I wrote was the edge of discourse. I mean, how far can we go into discourse, and do we need to use other medium than semantic language, I mean, articulated language, in order to translate or to transform the thing? And how does this expression, this notion of expression, deal with another part, which is the representation, which is another way to also to introduce a kind of distancing between the world and the one who represents. So I think that's maybe another question that could be raised, the relationship between the two terms. And second thing, which is the how far can we go in these notions? I think there is maybe a question which is ambience and atmosphere, and do they also, I mean, is there any, I mean, the same answer to this question, which is, are they always or not related to a specific place or space? I mean, can we detach the atmosphere or the ambience from the space-time? Mm-hmm. So I think that's the question of the situatedness of those notions. Do they relate always to a specific space-time of experience, or can it be detached from it? And how far can be detached from it? So, in a way, maybe that's a way to question the different entries to get into the notion, which is what room is there for space? Is it a really grounding part of the notion, or is it just a kind of a complementary or?
When you say what room is there for space?
For example,
space or
I think in several papers, where like this idea that we could talk about atmosphere without relating to any specific place. For example, the figure of people and the idea of what emanates the aura of people could be also a way to get into the ambience. So without any kind of space, or maybe the answer was maybe the space is the relationship between interior exterior and the ecstatic part of the aura of the figure, but without linked to a specific built space, for example. Mm. So is there any, how do we deal with that? And is it one of the limits of the notion to say, well, it has to be some related to a specific situation or not?
I think that was something that came up on this paper about the, I certainly remember picking up, which is about the images of Mother India, and I'm going to forget the name, where the visual expression, where the visual representation was of a, you know, almost, which, you know, in classical iconography is the halo or whatever, but in this sense is a kind of intensification of the air around. So as you say, it's a kind of, well, for those of a certain generation with English is the best language, so it's unfair, a ready breakfast, there was a breakfast cereal, you know, in the 1970s, where you ate the cereal and you would feel the air around you would glow. you know, so that was the way in which the mother could protect their child. They can send them to school with this glow, which is not quite the same as an aura, because it's based in the stomach and in a product, but it's a kind of caring, or it's a kind of something that you transport, thinking about that word. So I said, is it that it's an intensification of the air, or are we talking about the even an aura of a place, or the atmosphere, something that you walk through, that you encounter? Is it, so that's, I suppose, thinking about when you were saying what's not rhythm, I suppose, or what's not atmosphere, I found myself yesterday thinking what would be the destruction of atmosphere. I said to Rosanne, can you destroy ambiance? And she said no. She said categorically, no, you can't destroy it. And I thought, what, a bomb would destroy it? would it? Because it, you know, just replace it with another. So that is to say, is there anywhere, even if we're talking about the non-place, you know, which has no ambiance or atmosphere, I suppose the capital would be to kind of, this is something we put the right figures in place and they will bring this thing. You know, we put the bring the artist into the neighbourhood and it will, you know, change the ambiance. They will give off something which will be captured by. And this is something I was thinking about membranes as well, about osmosis, about visions, whether we talk about inside and outside, or whether there's a kind of permeable nature of the atmosphere, whether it's something that enters, you know, the skin is not actually the limit, but something that moves in and out, in between, and again, exterior and interior.
And brings us back to the idea of resonance, I guess.
Yes.
Can I take up the ready break?
Yes, please do.
Okay, I want to preface. I'll get back to ready break in a second. Preface that with there's a quote from the book edited by Brian Massumi, A Shock to Thought, Expression After Deleuze and Guattari, where he says that the force of expression strikes the body first, directly and unmediatedly. So it passes transformatively through the flesh before being instantiated in subject positions, etc., etc., etc. So the body, fresh in the throes of expression, incarnates not an already formed system, but a modification, a change. So expression isn't bent. So this reminded me also of Martin's discussion of the role that the intensity of a gesture and language, even if you can't understand it, the intensity of what it is, the voice, is part of this force of expression. But Ready Break, okay, had an ad when I was a child, okay, and the tagline was, Derek was really boring until he tried Ready Break, okay? So, you say Ready Break.
You say boring.
I feel that in my body.
As resonate.
Something that I've tried to escape for years from. But it happens first to my body. I mean, I don't so you think about it, I hear the kind of ready break.
Yes.
And my place in the room kind of changes. So that also reminded me, I guess, of how maybe memory and objects and the relationship between memory, objects, ideas has this kind of transformative effect, which. Mm. Is immediate like that, and it's only after the fact of its happening in your body that you start to make sense of it.
Which sort of goes back to another way of, I think, addressing the same moment. Someone did mention shock and trauma, and that immediately made me think of Bart's essay on which one is it? Where he took denotation, connotation. The someone combined with the title of the essay, which is completely escaped. The rhetoric of the image, where he talks about the difference between denotation and connotation, a very famous distinction in the essay, where at the end, very end, he asks, is there pure denotation? Can there be pure denotation? And the answer is made, he gives to himself at that time, is in the moment of trauma. So that's the kind of where there's no connotation whether the Derek, the Reggie Brechito or not.
Not quite as wrong.
But the connotation kind of fills in, and he's saying, and is that possible in an image? No, because there's maybe a split second, or to have a moment of pure denotation would induce a trauma. And I'm sort of wondering, like we're talking about, you know, interruption or something, like the idea of introducing a trauma into an obvious, as a way of challenging, as a way of critiquing, as a way of... And there's something in me that keeps wanting to bring in a notion of a vertical and a horizontal here, I suppose, as an interruption would be to introduce a notion of something vertical into something which is otherwise an exchange, a transaction, a synchronous and diachronous change, another view of language change. And also the necessity for the slippage between denotation or connotation or trauma of time. Time, you know, time stops at that moment. the translation of one into the other is a process of across time. Maybe a split second, he said.
And I was also just trying to think about the place-specific or the site-specific aspect of the point that you were making, and how it might also be about relation specificity or object specificity or word specificity that might not be place-specific, sort of like tied to a particular location, but tied to a certain cluster or constellation of relations between things, words, etc.
If we introduce at this point the idea of the border, which I think is both a place and obviously a sort of state. We were talking yesterday, I think Paul was pointing out that the glass wall behind where we were standing at the beginning of the tour is in effect the border. But beyond that is France, French territory. I think it was Robert was talking about a collection of photographs or images, a big national newspaper showing images of borders, some of which were a difference in the side of the, you know, down the middle of the street, and others which are in essence not necessarily a national border, but now, thinking especially of Gaza and other places, it's under war, and in Belfast, in the 1980s certainly, where walls would go up within a city, so it's the same place, but there's a wall down the middle of it. What does that do to the? You know, can we talk about one place or one space or either side of a wall, or so that there may be lots of, in other words, I suppose I'm trying to say there could be a situation about the thing of border, which is a cluster around which certain kinds of relationships or ambiance or something might be discussed within a different setting, and it might be very continuing, long board. how useful is that to bring in the notion of, I say, that a boundary, but also border, which very often people were talking about migrants and things yesterday, or I was thinking of a very specific project that Arte ran, French German TV channel, it was on the website, of filming someone in Gaza from both sides of the West Bank, so the Palestinian Israeli, and both could be accessed and were visible next to each other, just daily life, just a kind of video blog. So that there was a means of crossing the border, of experiencing only visually okay or the life in both sides. And in some senses it was inviting, I think, the viewer to kind of realise that the things were not different. Also to ground it in the everyday rather than the discourse around territory or politics or bigger politics. But that was specifically about trying to elide a border. But I wonder if it would be possible for this tour.
Okay, the question of border, and that's also the question of the transmission or propagation. I think that was raised when we talk about the Olympics. I think it was very interesting in the sense that I think there was like at least two different ways to articulate this question. One is more maybe linked to the idea of ambience, and basically people were talking about ambience, were talking about the senses, the diversity of the senses, the separation of the senses, how is it possible to separate and then to unify them again. So it was like one process which was basically dissociate and unify. And another one, more coming from the atmosphere kind of notion, which was much more like the transmission, which was like the process not that much of separating or unifying, but of imitating, transferring. How, for example, the term was used when you pass the torch to somebody else during the Olympics, so the ambience will go from a place to another one, so there will be transmission. And so it brings maybe the question of the mobility, which is not only the mobility of people, but also mobility of atmosphere that can also move from a place to another one, to a specific. And I think so there's like two different kind of processes that are both one dissociating, unifying, and the other one transmitting, imitating, maybe much more close to Gabriel Tarr's theory or this kind of thought. So, but the question is, so is there really a difference between ambience and atmosphere if we start from these two different kind of way to think? And I'm not that sure about that, because I think there's another term that is very important we already raised, which is resonance, but also affect, or affective tonality, the situation. And I think that is a common notion that applies both to atmosphere. We saw how atmosphere brings the question of affect and affectivity was very much the basis of it. And at the same time, when we raise the question in terms of ambience, of the unifying of the senses, and we say, okay, how can we deal? I mean, of course, there's a way to separate them in order to study them and to really deal with each of them, with the sound, with the light, with the hair. But when we try to reassemble the senses, the affective part is maybe one of the basic dimension that enables us to unify the sensory experience. So in a way, the affective or the affect is a kind of common notion between atmosphere and ambience. And on the other side, with the atmosphere, I mean, if we talk about atmosphere in terms of affect, we need also a way to embody or to incarnate or to give a materiality of the affect. And maybe this materiality of the affect could be traced to the senses, so brings back to the senses. So the question is, I mean, does it make sense to dissociate the two notions, and how far we can go in the dissociation, knowing that there is like two different processes at stake, but at the same time, a common notion, which maybe is the idea of affect that brings them together. If it makes sense.
That also raises a methodological question. Which I took to be part of the difference between different presentations. So if there's an affective tonality to a particular, you know, relation-specific atmospheres or ambiances, I missed the start of this event, so I'm unclear if somebody at the beginning said, this is the difference between these two terms, or this is how they're going to
fix it. No, it's just the
Sorry, I didn't miss out on that revelation. So if it's this affective tonality, methodologically then, how does one get a sense of that in terms of social science research? So through measurement, and the kinds of diagrammatic abstractions that we use after the fact of that measurement, which in some ways isn't, or you could imagine Tard kind of being interested in playing around with that kind of measurement and abstraction insofar as it would allow you to track and trace the kind of movement of affect across different populations. And at the same time as I can see, at the same time I see the difficulty that there is with that kind of abstraction, because something about the quality of experience is missing from it. So that kind of diagrammatic way of making affect explicit versus the, or atmosphere explicit versus a kind of form of commentary or commentating. So I'd also be thinking about radio commentary, sports commentary, as a kind of technique of event transmission. And one of the technical challenges in the early days of sports commentary was how one both gathers and transmits an atmosphere at a particular location, and then such that it's felt elsewhere. And this is radio commentary, but it seems to me that really good radio commentary tells a story that isn't necessarily just about the details. So methodologically, then, it would be interesting to try and think about a form of commentary that isn't just about descriptive details, but actually is about tone and, you know, the quality of how it is one tells the story. And I guess that's what somebody like Katie or Kathleen Stewart is trying to do in her writing, is to take that kind of argument seriously. So there's always a tension there between abstraction and some sense of the authenticity of a qualitative encounter, which is a kind of methodological issue that seems to cut across some of the papers.
Can I just pick up on that? Because I'm just looking back at my notes of your first introductory remarks. I see there was no simple distinction or clear or reductive distinction. You did allude to a kind of implicit difference between something which was about bodies and phenomenon and another which was atmosphere, which was more sort of diffuse and an omnipresent or kind of presence. And that, I think, that's when you're pointing, picking up on sports commentary, is interesting just from where I think one of the briefs we had was to kind of somehow relate this back to our own practice, our own sensibility. And in thinking about, when I was thinking about possibly giving a paper at this wonderful field event, I was thinking about my sort of field of film and how I could somehow bring in this notion of translation, and apart from a word I mentioned earlier, like rendering, transmitting, you can say, but I was thinking about the days of very early film, and as well as thinking about trains and stations, that's your tie especially, I was drawn to thinking about the kind of events that film was used for, the kind of witnessing, the whatever, and alongside the kind of massive exit from the factory that was, and the parade, which I was very interested in, was the sporting event. If you look, there's a big cachet of early pop, ordinary commercial film. There's a lot of very small commercial film producers and makers around 1902, 1903, so very early days, a lot of this has now been found, you know, intact, and so recently sort of brought to light. And a lot of that is summarised in kind of the sports films, the leisure films. And partly, I think the function was to kind of to be there, not only match of the day. You can see your team, you know, and see it in close up. And sorry, match of the day for other cultures is a big football program that shows matches that have happened that same day. So you don't have to be at this match, but every Saturday night or Sunday night, you will sit in front and watch a selection of matches of the day, and it will involve the close up, the goal repeated, the views from different stands, and as you were saying, that ability to be there is often in the kind of editing or the choice of camera positions, how to transmit that sense of being there when all you have is maybe sound and image, and you have no sense of smell or of mass. And then I was also thinking that in terms of how now the atmosphere of protest is, or the presence of protest is transmitted through YouTube, through people recording and calling on others to bear witness to what's happening through, you know, uploading. So the sense of the being there-ness, you know, that you were talking about, the sense of commentary. So is there a commentary implicit in the editing? Which is very, very clear. You know, you can see the same event filmed by three different people and they'll come out with a different interpretation of it. Even if each of those is called a documentary or has some claimed news truth value. But the simple, as I said, the essence of kind of being there-ness, which is partly what we were talking about, how you capture atmosphere, how you... So the now is very often seems to be linked to a notion of being live, like live from the Olympics, live broadcast, live in real time, as if that's actually to do with the kind of immediacy or a sense of communicating an atmosphere, or people collecting in a particular place to watch the same thing, which I'm sure you talked about, you know, the kind of mass screens that we had, not just for the Olympics, but for other big events where people have kind of gathered simply to be watching the same thing, and it happens in public houses and cafes, I'm sure, as well, where people watch the same thing as a being there, being here and being there.